and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Now, few want to imagine trauma ever entering their lives, but what to do once it happens can make even the most effective person or family member struggle to find answers. The latest in trauma research, assessment methods, interventions, and prevention strategies for those who have been traumatized is on the agenda, or all are on the agenda, for a four-day conference coming next week. Dr. Stephen Choi is a clinical psychologist. He's the co-founder and co-chair of the Hawaii International Summit on Violence Prevention, now in its 14th year. And Dr. Choi joins us this today. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Nice to have you here. Although it's not exactly a fun subject to talk about, the idea of trauma and how we define trauma has changed so much, particularly in the last 10 to 15 years, at least looking at it from the outside and how people talk about trauma. How do you see trauma having changed during that period?
Yeah, it's changed considerably. There wasn't a lot of focus on trauma causing the psychological problems that we see in children and adults until probably the last 15 years or so. And now as we did more of our studies, we find that there's a very high link to many of our psychological problems due to trauma that children and adults may be experiencing. So we actually have a whole section in our diagnostic manual now that's devoted to trauma. This is the first time it's ever been in there.
Where children are specifically being looked at and the traumas that they experience that have been then recapitulated in their lives as adults?
That's exactly right. And so we've been studying that a lot more. Our idea is to prevent it, work with children who may have experienced that trauma as early as possible to prevent this from being, at times, a lifetime problem.
This also seems to go to the idea that we regard children very differently now than we have in past. I mean, once upon a time, long, long, long ago, they were sort of looked at as being, you know, little adults. And then there was a point where they were looked at as being those who were so unformed that nothing really mattered what happened around them, that they would forget it. It wouldn't have any bearing on their lives. But clearly not what you're talking about now.
Yeah, the major concerns is how they interpret the trauma that they've experienced, and many of our kids misinterpret that. Many of them think that they're the cause of the trauma that they've experienced, and that guilt stays with them for a long period of time.
Guilt or the idea that somehow they deserve it?
That too. And because of that, they don't develop very well. They have problems in school. There's poor peer relationships. And if we don't deal with it, many of our kids end up in prison or in psychiatric facilities.
Do you have a sense of how many children this has been affecting in just very recent times? Any data on that for Hawaii?
Well, there's, in terms of interpersonal trauma, we have about 1,200 children that are reported to and have been confirmed to be physically abused or neglected, and that causes most of the major trauma in our children. So it's quite a bit, a large number.
That's maybe physical trauma, but those who have witnessed trauma, something happening to a parent, something happening to a friend or a loved one, and then they internalize that and carry it with them for a while. Do you have any sense of how many of those kids there are? Because that seems to be potentially a much larger number.
Yes, this is something that even our field didn't think about before, and it is now the priority. Probably about 2 to 3 times the amount of children that have been abused or neglected have witnessed that. And now we're finding out that just witnessing the domestic violence or violence causes almost the exact same psychological problems as being abused themselves.
And for people who have been beaten, maybe people who have been homeless and found themselves, for whatever reason, on the street and been the recipient of violent behavior, or those certainly that we've talked about who've come back from war and have experienced PTSD. Our whole notion of what PTSD, though, that also seems to be expanding.
That's correct. I think that we didn't realize the impact of these events and how long it lasts for children and adults. And many of them have internalized it because no one believed that they may be having problems with this or they couldn't deal with it. And so it just built up. And that's what we call post-traumatic, because that person may not be experiencing the trauma right now, but those symptoms can last for years and years if it doesn't get worked with. And then that impairs a person's overall development.
there seem to be many different ways that people are trying to address PTSD. In Newsweek this week, there's an article about a woman who is a psychologist in Pennsylvania who developed a treatment called Comprehensive Resource Model and or Resources Model. And that seems to be something that, although it's kind of obscure to a lot of other psychologists, is something that's taken root in Britain. I understand there's supposed to be a study in the UK and or a UK-US study happening this fall. But my point is really there seem to be different ways that people are trying to approach the whole way in which PTSD is addressed, not just to understand that it's wider and bigger, but also how you treat it differently for different populations. Do you see more of those modalities happening now?
Yes. I mean, previously, we didn't see this as a major problem, so there wasn't a lot of research on it. Right now, there's quite a bit of research that are coming up. We're using mindfulness. We're using some physical ways to help deal with the trauma that they're experiencing. Many of our individuals develop, hypervigilance. They're very concerned about everything that might be going on, hypersensitive. And so it causes a lot of physical problems also. So we're working on those. We're looking at some psychoneurological ways to deal with the trauma that they've been experiencing, because it does create problems in the brain development and functioning also.
And what do you see happening with psychologists in Hawaii as they try to grapple with this too? Any particular research that's happening here that we've yet to talk about?
Yeah, we're doing some research right now on the effects of witnessing domestic violence rather than just the experience of the abuse. And we're trying to see if there is a difference. There's no research out there right now to see that, see if we need to approach it differently or if they react the same way as being physically abused. And there really is no answer right now. So we're doing some groundbreaking research right now in Hawaii.
That will set quite a benchmark by the time you finish it, you hope.
We hope, yes.
And when do you expect that study to complete?
We hope it'll be finished in about 2 years. We're collecting the data right now.
Well, we will look forward to talking to you about that and wish you all the best with the coming conference.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Stephen Choi is a clinical psychologist and the co-founder and co-chair of the Hawaii International Summit on Violence Prevention. It'll be held next week at the Hawaii Convention Center.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Locations, Noheia Gallery, and Straub Clinic and Hospital.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, a guitarist who combines classical and slack key styles. First, your quiz.
Coming up in the program, we'll hear about the effort to save Hawaii's marine ecosystems from harmful chemicals found in many sunscreen. With that in mind, today's backyard quiz will focus on other marine conservation efforts in the Aloha State. To say that the statistics on Hawaii's marine life are staggering would be an understatement. Including the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, there are over 410,000 acres of living reef across Hawaii, and those reefs are home to more than 1,200 species of plants and animals that are found nowhere else on Earth. With such an abundance of rare and fragile life, extensive conservation efforts have been undertaken to prevent or protect Hawaii's natural biodiversity. One method is the designation of certain waters as a marine life conservation district. This program began in the 1960s, and today we want to know what was the very first marine life conservation district to be designated in Hawaii. If you know the answer, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And as you're listening to the rebroadcast of The Conversation, we won't be taking any calls to answer the backyard quiz, but you can always call us at 11 a.m. when we're live.
Aloha, this is Frank Haas. I'm a member of the board of Hawaii Public Radio, and a big mahalo to everyone who has listened to the station over the years, and we look forward to bringing you all the stuff that makes this community so great.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
Guitarist Ian O'Sullivan brings a unique combination of skills to his music. As an accomplished classical guitarist who was the first guitarist from Hawaii to be accepted to Yale University's School of Music, with a thorough grounding in the slack key styles of his ancestors and a background as a self-taught player of reggae and garage band rock and roll. They're all in the ingredients of his musical personality, and he's with us in our studio to tell us how those all fit together.
Aloha.
You were self-taught before you were taught, is that right?
Oh yeah, many Hawaii musicians, you start out because you get drawn to the instrument, you know.
Yeah.
I saw my dad when I was a wee, 4 or 5 years old, I think, play a couple songs, Maui Chimes, and I thought I have to do that.
Yeah.
And so I only knew how to play those couple songs. I learned by ear basically from watching and picking up. Just for my own desire to play, and eventually I did get to surround myself by a lot of really good teachers, and yeah.
That happens a lot more with guitar, just because it's an instrument you might bring to a party or play in the backyard, or it's frequently heard in informal settings. Yeah.
Right. Oh yeah. In Mokulaia, where I grew up, we didn't really have an ala moana down the street or anything where I could hear music. Mm-hmm. So even just hearing a live music performance was quite a rarity. I didn't have a lot of family that played music around me. I do have a lot of family that plays, but mm-hmm. we were sort of secluded out in the country there. So, I was lucky if I did get to hear a live performance, and I was always, really enamored. And I think it was partly that sort of rural, growing up and being starved for taught, a formal music education, that, mm-hmm. that when I did finally make it to the university, I just, ate as much as I could. So
in part, you have to be hungry for it when get exposed to that kind of education.
Definitely,
as well.
Yeah.
As a, when people say classical guitarist, they think automatically that you're playing, classical guitar repertoire.
Right.
As opposed to, it's a different kind of guitar. It's a different technique.
Right. Yeah. I think of classical guitar more as an approach.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at classical music, just in general, it's a 600-year tradition of music, that spans many countries and styles. It's not confined to a groove. It's not confined to any certain grouping of notes. Mm-hmm. really classical music can do anything and everything and combine every style. And so that's sort of my current relationship with classical guitar is more of a creator and arranger. Rather than playing the standard war horses, like Segovia's repertoire and things like that. So,
well, Segovia brought a repertoire to the wider world that got locked in place for a few generations of classical guitarists to follow.
Yep.
But it for a while, anyway, it wasn't seen as a vehicle to play anything you want.
Right. Yeah. You had to. Well, that was, I think, partially the guitar trying to earn its place in the classical music world.
Right.
And so if you were a classical guitarist and you went out and played, Jimi Hendrix or something like that, you know, that you might get some funny looks.
Yeah.
Which is actually why I studied with Benjamin Verdery at Yale University, because he does play Jimi Hendrix on the mm-hmm. classical guitar. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's great, you know. And it's the way he interacts with the instrument, the way he thinks about melody and rhythm and just sort of having classical musician sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what he brings to the music. So classical guitar, you know, people usually think of old music, but it can really be, in the right hands, anything you like.
Well, I remember when somebody played me a recording, I think it was the Kronos Quartet playing mm-hmm. Purple Haze.
Oh, wow, yeah, yeah.
And I realized, you know, a tune is a tune, and if you can make it work for any kind of instrumentation, if it's got value, it's going to be expressed that way.
Right, right. Yeah, nothing like a good melody, you know.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, also, I really think that in the world of music in the last few decades especially, an awful lot of barriers have gone down.
Right.
Because Segovia was an enormously conservative
right.
artist.
Right, right.
This is right, this is not right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, for all his genius, a bit dogmatic about
right.
what you could and could not do. Right.
Right. And there's that whole conversation. I mean, Segovia did many, many good things.
Yeah.
But he was such a dictator in a way about the way that the guitar should be played and down to using his exact fingerings, even for Bach. And it's mm-hmm. like, well, Bach didn't even write for the guitar, so how could you say that that's the way to play it? You
right.
know? And so, but this is the nice thing also about being a generation away from Segovia, you know, because I don't know if I would have had the same cultural acceptance in the guitar world being a creator
mm-hmm.
during that time, during his reign. It had to be Spanish repertoire from a respected orchestral classical composer.
Villa-Lobos.
Whoever, you know, Tedesco or Toroba, mm-hmm. Torina, you know, all these composers that he commissioned were fabulous and well-established, and that was kind of his mission, you know, and he was very successful, and thanks to that mission, I have a friend in Puerto Rico, Ermelindo Ruiz, who's arranging wonderful traditional Puerto Rican music, you know, classical piano music, transferring it over to the guitar. And
mm-hmm.
I have another friend, Maya Radovanliha, Serbian woman, who just came out and played at the Guitar Series, and she's arranging Balkan music for classical guitar. And so there is sort of this new generation of creating new repertoire, but reflective of place.
And then you get into the whole thing of transcending limitations of the instrument when you get into things like Balkan music with very, very wide intervals, different rhythms,
mm-hmm.
very different mm-hmm. rhythms, and you have to sort of break out of your patterns to get into that kind.
Oh, definitely, yeah. And the art of arranging for the guitar is it's quite challenging, you know, because it is a very limited instrument in ways, just like the ukulele, you know.
Sure.
And so to make something like My Guitar Gently Weeps, like Jake does on the ukulele, is mm-hmm. quite a feat, to make it effective. And same thing for the guitar. We have, we even have arrangements of, Pictures of Exhibition, Mussorgsky. You know, that's been done on the guitar, and I would never do that. That's insane. But
it took a lot of work.
Yeah, and it is possible. And so I think that, the guitar is one of the most versatile and colorful, you know, orchestra in a box.
Well, we'll get a chance to hear some of the colors that you can paint in the next half of the show. Thanks, Ian.
Great, thanks.
Ian O'Sullivan's most recent CD is Songs of the North Shore, and he'll be back in the second half of our show to perform live.
Recently on Town Square, we asked how taxes could become more fair to those who foot the bill, especially those who earn the least. CivilBeat.org reporter Anita Hofschneider joins us now with another look at that question. Aloha.
Aloha, Bethan.
Good to talk to you. Now, the two big bills that we've been all looking at are HB 209 and SB 648. Each seems to have the support of its chamber's money chair. What does each do to create a little bit more fairness?
Well, both of them would extend and expand tax credits for low-income people while raising taxes on the wealthy. So in the past, advocacy groups have pushed to expand tax credits for low-income people to help give them bigger tax refunds so that they can handle the high cost of living in Hawaii. But this is the first year the proposal is paired with raising taxes on the wealthy. This would bring back some of the higher tax rates that were in place between 2009 and 2015 as a result of the recession.
And how much broad support does that have?
Well, so far, both of the measures have passed each of their chambers. But as you know, we're still midway through the session, so we have a long way to go. And there is opposition from organizations like the Chamber of Commerce, the Tax Foundation of Hawaii, that say that this could actually hurt small businesses.
The idea being that people would simply not be able to hire as many people, that they would have a higher tax burden on them. But what about the idea of that the Tax Foundation has also floated that, well, maybe the folks who are at the lowest end shouldn't even be filing taxes?
Well, that's in the Senate version of the bill, and Senator Takuda is now mulling over the House version of the bill, and she might actually eliminate the income taxes for the poorest group of people, which sounds like a good idea to many. But I talked to somebody from the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice who said that given that many people in Hawaii have to deal with the regressivity of the general excise taxes, that actually removing the income tax burden on the poorest people may not be as helpful as providing them with bigger tax refunds.
Refunds that they would see immediately or refunds that wouldn't come until the end of the year?
You know what? On that point, I'm not sure. But there's definitely a lot more to work out on this bill. Right now, Senator Takuda said she's going to make a decision on the House version on Tuesday, and it's likely the measure will end up in conference committee.
It seems that that's where it's destined, given the differences between those two versions. But at this point, there are those who are still out there strongly lobbying for that, the usual suspects?
In favor of the proposals?
Right.
Actually, this year we have a big diversity of organizations. For example, the Sierra Club is actually really in favor of House Bill 209, and they said that they decided to back this bill this year because they said in order for people to be better environmental stewards, it's very helpful if they aren't dealing with, you know, financial insecurity.
And what about the Democratic Party itself?
The Democratic Party of Hawaii is also backing the bills. A lot of progressive groups are in favor of this. In fact, there's a big variety of organizations, 19, I believe, that have formed the Hawaii Tax Fairness Coalition that are really lobbying lawmakers to make this be the year for tax reform.
It's going to be a very interesting Tuesday.
Yes, indeed.
Thanks very much, Anita.
Thank you so much, Bethan.
Every day we bring you a reality check from CivilBeat.org, today featuring reporter Anita Hofschneider. This being a Friday, one of the things we like to do is take a look at what the news department is working on for the coming week. And to help us with that, as always, HPR's news director Bill Dorman joins us. Hey there.
Aloha, Beth Ann. It's always good to check in on a Friday and see what may be coming. You know, it's one of those things. Some things are predictable. Some things we don't know exactly what's going to be going on. One thing that we do know that we're going to be getting an update on, actually, is the folks at the Hokulea. This has been going on now in terms of the length of the voyage itself. They're coming back home in June, you know, and that time is rapidly approaching. But meanwhile, they've had some challenging little segments of the travel, and it's been very interesting to sort of follow along. And one of the most challenging, going from Easter Island, Rapa Nui, to Pitcairn Island, this is going from one tiny outcropping to another tiny outcropping, and you talk about the power of wayfinding, and that really has been demonstrated. We've got some great stories that Casey Harlow is able to talk with the folks on board the Hokulea about that. We're going to be hearing that this coming week. Because now they're on the way to Marquesas is the next stop for Hokulea, but that will be part of it.
And as they are hopping across the ocean, we really haven't heard that much lately from them, except to get, you know, fits and spurts about how difficult it has been, ergo maybe why we don't have as many reports from them. But very curious to see what happens from this point forward. What else as we look into next week? I mean, we were looking for a lot of answers that have just sort of been, amorphically moving around, and we don't know exactly what they will be, but we're still in a legislative session.
Exactly, and lots of still in motion, as you say, at the ledge. And part of being in motion, of course, the rail and the GET surcharge and where that goes and when that goes following that along. It's sort of wayfaring of its own variety, and travel. Just back on the idea of travel and tourism as an important economic underpinning of a lot of what we do here, and a lot of not just source of tax revenue but business as well. The Hawaii Tourism Authority each spring gives sort of steps back, gives the outlook, gives sort of its emphasis for the coming year. And that's always one of those stories that's interesting to look at, not just in the headlines, but to drill down a bit. And we're going to be having that this coming week. So Wayne Yoshioka will be all over that as well.
Good. Not just top line forecast.
Exactly.
That's the kind of stuff we like. Thanks so much. We'll look forward to that coming next week from HPR's news department. And of course, as we always do on a Friday, we take a look into our mailbag, email and otherwise, to see what you've had to say in the last week.
And following Monday's interview with East-West Center President Richard Volstick about a possible loss of funding for the center, Angie Van Horn tweeted, "East-West Center is important institution for Pacific region. We must continue to support it." And David Day tweeted, "The handwriting has been on the wall for years now. How about developing a biz model that is self-sustaining?"
Barbara Stern is a Hawaii Rescue Coordinator for the American Bouvier Rescue League. After Monday's reality check, she emailed, "I have serious concerns about dogs and other animals being in places where they do not belong for health and other reasons here in Hawaii, unless they are legitimate service dogs. People are just buying jackets and cards on the internet saying emotional support dog. Organizations that train real service dogs are expressing great concern about this, as there have been incidents of such dogs who are not trained attacking service dogs and giving a bad name to real service dogs when they do other things like poop and pee at Costco. I'm not sure what the answer is, but people are taking advantage of this indecision and taking dogs and other animals where they don't belong."
And following yesterday's healthcare discussion, Paula Rodellis of Unite Here Local 5 wrote this, "I really enjoyed your Town Square episode on how the health care changes on the federal level would impact Hawaii. We're hearing a lot of concerns that people in Hawaii are already struggling with paying for their medical costs and are worried that it's going to get even worse if Trump Care passes. Our union has been strongly opposing Trump Care. The Hilton Garden Inn workers ratified their very first union contract today. Many of them were paying hundreds each month to cover their children or were relying on MedQuest. Unionization is going to give HGI workers full family medical coverage. Now we have 105 additional members and their families who won't be relying on the state for their coverage." And we thank you for your letters. Our talk back line is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, now accepting applications for summer school featuring camps on drone photography and filmmaking for girls and boys in preschool through grade 12. SacredHearts.org.
This legislative session, lawmakers were met by bills to stop the sale or at least to regulate the use of products with oxybenzone. Recent research shows damage from the sunscreen in coastal waters. One measure that survived crossover earlier this month has now undergone several revisions, but advocates remained energized. That includes lead researcher Craig Downs, the executive director of a science and environmental nonprofit, Heraclitus Environmental Laboratory. Craig Downs first talked about his studies almost a year ago on Town Square. He's on the phone with us now from his lab in Virginia. Aloha.
Aloha, Beth Ann.
Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you.
Now, I know that you had wanted to see oxybenzone out and out banned because the industry has many other alternatives that it can use, and you've said that even industry itself hasn't been all upset about this idea. Why do you think that didn't carry its way into the legislative part of all of this and that it sort of had to get winnowed down a bit?
To be honest, I don't know. Everybody thought this was going to be a sure, easy thing. We had some hiccups. One of them came from the Department of Land and Natural Resources. They were still a little hesitant about the science and what it would mean for their agency and how to enforce it. Same thing with the Department of Health. My understanding is that they didn't know all the science behind it, both the human mammalian toxicological studies as well as the marine ecotoxicological studies. And they're just kind of gun shy. And again, they didn't have a clear idea, I think, of how would they implement it, what the budgets would be, a lot of the details.
It seems, though, that with the measure that's still on the move, good as it is, it still has those same questions. How do you enforce something when you say you can't have people using, oxybenzone in, a marine conservation area?
Well, that one's a little bit easier because a marine conservation area is an intensively managed area by DLNR or an NGO. In the case of Hawaii, it would be Department of Land and Natural Resources. They would... one idea is just engaging tourists and swimmers and people who are visiting the area that, oxybenzone sunscreen poses a potential threat to the ecosystem, especially restoration.
Are you asking them, show me your sunscreen, or are we talking about a really large campaign to let visitors and residents know that this type of sunscreen is not welcome in a marine conservation district?
I think it's a bad idea to even think about confiscating or, coming in with the Maui Police Department, big guys coming in and saying, don't wear this. Let me check what you have. That's not a good experience for tourism. That's not a good experience for Hawaii.
So how do you keep that away from the coral that through your research, which we talked about last year, that showed that we're really doing so much damage to the corals that they can't come back from?
Well, if you can do things incrementally, that's better than not doing anything at all. It would be in the best interest of Hawaii's coral reefs to do something that's rather comprehensive and soon actionable, that's now, because we might be hit by another coral bleaching event like we were last summer. And if it hits again, that's more coral reef degradation, that's less probability of restoration and recovery. That's bad for Hawaii.
And we're seeing a lot of these episodes around the world. Even the knowledge that, what we thought had been happening with the Great Barrier Reef down under is, in fact, a lot worse. Your point is that, even a small ounce of prevention would be a good thing if it can actually happen. At this point, with this bill, do you think the chances are good that this thing is actually going to go through, or that they're going to go back and say, we want to see even more science?
I think it has a good chance of going through, in some form. I've talked to a number of of representatives and senators, and they seem to be quite excited about it. They want to do something about it. They want to show leadership. However it comes out is, who knows? I mean, it's the Hawaii legislature. Anything can happen.
I think one of the questions that you seem to be asking is, how do lawmakers do something that will be meaningful and not something that just, you know, seems like a good idea because of the research that you've shown them, but something that will actually make a difference? Isn't that the bottom line, trying to make a difference with the corals?
Yes. And if the Hawaii legislature, as a small step this year, wants to pass something where they ban it or do a high amount of regulatory action, meaning like education and public outreach in conservation areas like Hananama Bay, Ahii, Hanaloa Bay, those areas might see an increased probability of restoration. I mean, when you go to Hanama Bay, the inner reef, there's nothing there. It's just rubble and rocks. There's no coral. There's no sea urchins. There's nothing. And if we can drop the amount of the bad chemicals that are causing endocrine disruption and inhibiting coral reef recruitment, we might see those areas restored. And for example, Hanama Bay, you could actually regulate and ban it. You know, you could do things creatively, like, for example, having a surrender bin. And if you surrender something, an oxybenzone sunscreen, you get 50% off or 75% off on a non-oxybenzone sunscreen being sold at the concession stand.
Or maybe there might even be someone who would be willing to, you know, someone in industry who would be willing to donate sample sizes of something that would get them through the day and just give it to them if they surrender something.
Absolutely. You wouldn't believe the number of cosmetic companies that they're saying, hey, do you need 4 or 5 cases of free product? You know, we'd like to send it to you. And I'm like, I can't accept it. So I think that would be a great program for DLNR in the city of Honolulu regarding Hanama Bay to actually do something with the cosmetic companies. You know, make it a joint partnership between industry and conservation.
Well, this week we saw the bill, which is now in its fifth version, survive the Ocean Marine Resources and Hawaiian Affairs Committee, now moving off to Commerce and Consumer Protection. No date yet, though, when that's supposed to be heard, but it looks like it's still on the move, and we'll be watching it. And thanks very much. Good to talk to you, as always.
Thank you, Beth Ann, and take care.
You too. Dr. Craig Downs is the executive director of the science and environmental nonprofit called Hereticus Environmental Laboratory. HEL focuses on forensic environmental investigation and engaging in solutions that are commercially and socially viable regarding ecological conservation and restoration. The bill we were talking about is SB 1150 HD2 SD2.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to name Hawaii's first marine life conservation district. According to the State Department of Land and Natural Resources, marine life conservation districts are designed to conserve and replenish marine resources through limiting or prohibiting fishing and other consumptive uses of designated waters. The DLNR is responsible for designating and managing MLCDs, and it takes suggestions from the state legislature and the public. Marine life conservation districts have been established across Hawaii and represent some of the island's best-known aquatic attractions, including Oahu's Shark's Cove, Manele Bay on Lanai, Maui's Honolulu Bay, and Kealakekua Bay on Hawaii Island. However, all of these were preceded by Hanauma Bay, located on Oahu's Ka'iwi Coast, which was designated Hawaii's first marine life conservation district in 1967.
And if you were listening to our preceding segment, we were talking to Dr. Craig Downs. We talked about Hanama Bay a fair bit. So maybe that was just a quiet little nod.
A strong hint.
This is true. But Andy Izutsu called us from Hilo, got the answer right, and will be receiving the prize. If you've got a backyard quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, helping strengthen the school-home connection with Home Edition, an online tool with reading and writing tailored to each student's ability. Achieve3000.com.
We talked with guitarist Ian O'Sullivan in the first half of our show, but we didn't get the opportunity to hear his music, so we're going to remedy that in our second half, and Ian's with us in our studio. Welcome back, Ian.
Aloha.
Your latest CD is Songs for the North Shore, and I'm interested in how a piece of music can reflect a place, a region.
Right.
That was your challenge in putting them together, right?
Right, yeah, and especially challenging because I don't sing.
Yeah.
I can in a pinch. I mean, you may catch me doing a harmony or something if I'm playing with some friends, but I'm definitely not a lead vocalist. So finding notes that can tell a story, you know, is a challenge.
Yeah.
And that was something that took me a couple years. I wrote 10 different pieces, actually over the span of probably about 5 years. A good chunk of them, about 8 of them I wrote in the last 2 years. And they all have something different, you know. Mm-hmm. So I wrote one song for the Night Marchers up on the North Shore.
Yeah.
And I use a descending fret-by-fret chromatic line to represent the walk mm-hmm. of the Night Marchers moving. I have another composition called Ka'ena Point, and I use a left-hand tapping technique to represent the current
mm-hmm.
moving through the water,
and it does evoke that just when you hear it. Yeah.
So that took a while to find something for every single place.
Yeah.
I have a melody for the birds. I thought that was, you know, something like a bird.
Mm-hmm.
And so everywhere, that one's for Loko'ea, a fish pond in Hala'iva.
Mm-hmm.
Finding notes that reflect either a gesture, a place, or a feeling, you know, takes some time. And I was very lucky. I had the inspiration in time to record a nice CD. So, yeah, 10 songs, all for the North Shore, from Kahuku to Ka'ena.
Well, let's pick one and let's see how you play.
Okay. So another way that I use Hawaiian music to influence my classical music is the use of slack key guitar tunings.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this song Loko'ea, I use a low C tuning, so I have to take the low E string on the guitar way down.
I love that low C though.
Down to a C, and then the next string down to a G. So it's sort of a pseudo half slack key, half standard classical mm-hmm. tuning.
But you get the bass notes you want that
yeah.
way.
Okay, so. This is a Loko'ea.
Thank you. That was lovely, Ian. Yeah. And a thought occurred to me as you were playing that, which is something that any aspiring composer might want to think about, is trust your melody.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Just like figure when you had that beautiful little simple figure that just, you know, let that breathe.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I do a lot of with...
Don't put a lot of garlands on it. Mm-hmm, you don't need them.
Mm-hmm. The simplicity, right? Yeah. Let the notes shine, you know. One of the beauties of the guitar is that each note holds a lot of weight.
Yeah.
You know, so if I were to play something like... on a piano, that exact same melody would seem very simplistic.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas on a guitar, I think partially it's the challenge. We have to use two hands.
Yeah.
On the same fret and find the same string in order to execute a note. Whereas a piano, we can drop our finger onto any key and get a sound.
Yeah.
Not to say that the piano is easier, that it is. Anyways, joking. But I think that it's, obviously a inferior instrument, but that's another conversation. I do think, though, that the piano, because of that, the complexity of the music does reflect that.
Well, so you can get in between the notes with a guitar in a way that's forbidden on a piano.
You just... Oh, many, many things. You know, we can get quarter tones, we can get bends, we can do vibratos, you know, we can make chimes, harmonics, we can do slides.
Yeah.
We can tap the instrument.
Yeah.
Different, many different sounds.
And we do. Ian, thanks so much for coming in. That really was a lovely piece. Thanks
thank you so much.
That. Ian O'Sullivan is a classically trained guitarist with a degree from Yale University. His CDs are Born and Raised and Songs for the North Shore, and you can learn more about him on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Kaiser Permanente and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
Well, when the weekend comes around, we think about what we're going to do with ourselves for the weekend, and there's always a lot of different activities going on throughout the state. Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us to look at events that are going on a little under the radar. And a lot of us have accumulated what we think of as useless old computer gear, right?
Oh, yes. I have some from over the years that I wanted to get rid of.
Me too.
Yeah. And you can do that tomorrow. The community recycling event at Kaneohe Bay Shopping Center is tomorrow from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. And it's free. Just bring your unwanted e-waste for secure destruction and recycling. Computers, keyboards, monitors, printers. There are no quantity limits. And you can also bring your documents for shredding, 3 boxes max per person. Go to shopkaneohebay.com for a complete list of items that they're accepting.
And I'm officially adding the word e-waste to my vocabulary.
Yes. No, that sounds like a great thing. I mean, you know, I would drive over the mountains
indeed,
to go over there.
Yeah. Well, and you can also spend a Saturday at the vacation home of the Ali'i.
Yes, it's called A Day at Hulihe'e Palace in Kailua Kona. There will be arts and crafts booths, food, and a bake sale. Local hula halau will provide entertainment on the grassy lawn fronting Kailua Bay. It's tomorrow at the palace from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. It's free, but donations will be accepted for that.
Pretty good way to spend a sunny afternoon on the Big Island.
And oh, yes.
Probably
yes.
Going to be sunny because it's Kona side,
yes,
right?
and beautiful, very beautiful.
Always.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a family event on Oahu.
Yes, it's happening on Sunday. It's the Taste of Honwanji Bazaar at the Honpa Honwanji Temple on Pali Highway. There will be ono food and drinks, entertainment, games, and a collection of handcrafted items. The bazaar will also feature cookbooks, plant sale, baked goods, fresh produce, a rummage sale, and specialty items from the Kailua and Mo'ili'ili Honwanji temples. This is happening on Sunday from 8:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., and this is free.
And as always, Derek, you've managed to find out about things that I certainly haven't heard of. Where do you get all this stuff?
Well, they're under the radar.
Oh, I see.
Yes, yes, Chris.
I guess that explains that. Thanks a lot, Derek.
Okay, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation at this point in our show every day to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, this is John Zach from Classical Pacific. I just want to say mahalo, obrigado, arigato gozaimasu, vinaka, and thank you so much for listening to HPR.
And thank you for joining us this week for The Conversation. We hope you're having a good Friday and we'll have a great weekend. And come back with us on Monday when we'll start to hear from one of the sides of the debate over easing of fishery restrictions in waters around the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. We'll hear the other side later in the week.
And Kumu Kahua takes on a challenging slate of one-act comedy.
We always like to hear from you, and you can call our talk back line whenever the spirit moves. That number is 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you've ever wondered about the music you hear on the show, you can find a playlist on our HawaiiPublicRadio.org page. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kosovich.
Lillian Song produces the program, and Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello, and I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kosovich. We'll see you on Monday right back here when we pick up The Conversation.